Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
To kick off this hour, John McClain joins us every Tuesday at this time. He's presented by FreelandChevy.com. Time to hit the NFL headlines. If you'd like to talk with John McClain, we're less than 30 days away from NFL training camp. 615-737-1045, our number.
And this is your chance to talk about your favorite team. Any story across the league, John McClain can talk about it right now. Phone lines wide open for the man in black himself, John McClain. 615-737-1045. 737-1045.
What's up, John?
All kind of good things, guys. What's up with y'all?
Just, you know, ready for the 4th. Some big celebrations here in Music City for sure. And ready for training camp just around the corner.
John, I'm never
ready for training camp, but when it gets here, I'm glad it is.
Yeah.
John, I happened to be watching some television over the weekend, and I stumbled across the Houston 93 edition of A Football Life on NFL Network. I had seen it before, but I watched it again and enjoyed it every bit as much as I had the first time. That was an unbelievable season that I'm sure you knew so many behind-the-scenes stories of that weren't told on television, but what a crazy story.
That was the most tumultuous season in NFL history. I've said that for decades, and when I have somebody challenge me, I reel off three things right off the top of the bat, which was the suicide of defensive tackle Jeff Baum, Baby Gate, with offensive tackle David Williams and Buddy Ryan throwing a sideline punch at Kevin Gilbride. Just those three things. Didn't count Warren Moon being benched for the only time in his career. It also didn't count them winning 11 games in a row. And, yes, there were all kind of things that went on there. And they interviewed me for 2 hours. I told them 2 hours worth of stories. A few got in, but they could have made that show 3 hours and still never have run out of material.
Well, and you're a pretty big part of it. You appear in it a lot. But the thing that jumped out to me, John, was we hear about the swagger of Buddy Ryan, but in that season at least, and Warren Moon talked about this a lot, Buddy Ryan came in and constantly made fun of the run and shoot of the offense. But Warren Moon said it was frustrating us because they couldn't do anything in practice to stop us. So he constantly made fun of Kevin Gilbride and of our offense, but couldn't do anything to stop it. But yet he hated the offense. I thought that was an interesting part of the division between offense and defense on that team.
Imagine if this was the setup today. Number one, what if Mike Vrabel, after games, had to go into a room and do his radio show and then take calls from the fans, in which every call, you moron, how did you do this, how did you do that? That was in their contract. Jack Pardee, the head coach, because I used to go in because it was my station, and I would listen. I would want to hear what he was being asked. And the offensive players hated Buddy Ryan. He tried to take credit later, saying that was his plan to motivate them. Well, they didn't need to be motivated. They were one of the highest-scoring offenses in the league. They'd been to the playoffs two previous years, blown two big leads. And Buddy Ryan never liked the run and shoot, period. Used to take shots at it even before he came here. And after he was hired by general manager Mike Hollaback, owner Bud Adams. Jack Pardee, the head coach, had nothing to do with it, and Buddy knew it. So Buddy acted like he didn't have to answer to Jack anything. Jack, who played linebacker for 15 years, should have kicked his butt early on, but that wasn't his style. So Buddy didn't pay any attention to him. There were times in practice where they would run defensive drills, then Buddy would tell the defense, go to the dressing room, while the offense and Kevin Gilbride were waiting to run their part of the game plan. So they hated him, and it all started at the Pro Bowl, where Bears linebacker Mike Singletary went into the Hall of Fame, and he brought Buddy to Hawaii to honor his contributions to Singletary's career. And Buddy had been hired, and he and I sat down by the team's hotel swimming pool, and I interviewed him, and he just trashed the offense and trashed Kevin Gilbride before he ever got to town. And players used to rip him during the season, the offensive players. One time their slot receiver, Ernest Gibbons, ripped him. We go to Buddy, said, "Hey, Buddy, what do you think?" Ernest Gibbons said, "This, this, this." And he goes, "Who's Ernest Gibbons?" At that time, Ernest, like, four-time Pro Bowl receiver. So I've never experienced anything like it, even when Jerry Glanville was there. Those were crazy seasons, too, for a variety of reasons. They should do a football life on Jerry Glanville. He was one of the biggest characters to ever be in any professional sports at any of them. And, but yes, if I would encourage people, if you see a football life on the 93 Oilers, you will not be disappointed.
I came in after all of this was over, John, and I think it's one of the areas that Jeff Fisher doesn't get any credit or mention among all the 7-9 jokes now. But when he got that job, he had to repair this whole offensive and defensive division, which may have been one of the biggest ever. Now, he saw an awfully big one with the Bears, too, which we've heard Dave McGinnis talk us through. But when I when I arrived in 96, there was still this feeling that the offense and defense were very separate. And I remember talking to Kevin Donnelly, the offensive lineman, about it and about Fisher's work to unify the Oilers into one team, which was a lot of work because there was a lot of leftover feeling about us and them and them and us. And that was a big repair job that people weren't really conscious of, that was a part of a young coach in a tough situation with the transition coming and the empty Astrodome and all of that, that Jeff had to do behind the scenes that most people weren't really thinking about.
When Fisher came here as defensive coordinator in 94, the Oilers were in the process of taking the biggest one-season plunge in NFL history, going from 12-4 to 2-14. And, of course, everybody thought they were moving to Nashville after the 95 season, and they were going to buy out of their lease. And I actually believe that Fisher benefited from all the controversy surrounding the move, and because it unified the players behind the scenes, they developed a bond because they were all going through that together, crowds of 15,000 media and fans against Bud Adams, and therefore they were against the team. And I thought Jeff did a tremendous job in unifying the team and also to have the records that he had going through something at the time was unprecedented. I remember one time I was interviewing Mike Shanahan, and Mike said, "I can't imagine what Fisher's going through. It's hard enough for me to win here, and I have control over everything. And every day I get up worried about what's going to be the next problem." And that's with everything being perfect. And I got John Elway quarterback, and here's Jeff having to go through what he went through. He thought, Shannon told me at the time, what Fisher was doing there was one of the best coaching jobs he'd ever seen.
It's as easy as pie.
Enable the 104.5 The Zone skill on your Amazon Echo. Just tell Alexa to enable the 104.5 The Zone skill. Then listen by saying, "Alexa, play 104.5 The Zone."
Midday 180 served up by Wendy's. John McClain with us. You can join him. 615-737-1045, our number. Coming up, John will give us some top moments from the life and career of Steve McNair. But first, we go to Bert. Bert, thanks for calling.
Hi, John.
Hello, Bert.
John, I'm a lifelong Green Bay Packers fan, and my question for you is, were you surprised or disappointed that it took so long for Jerry Kramer to get inducted to the Pro Football Hall of Fame? And I just wonder why it took so long.
Because of the competition and because there's so many Packers in there. And I'm on the seniors committee, and the way it works is five of us go to Canton every year in August. We spend the night before, they bring in two Hall of Famers to advise us. sometimes those guys are really helpful, sometimes they're not. And we go to dinner and we talk about the finalists. And in that year, 2 years ago, there were 21 senior finalists. Usually there are 15. So we spent all day going over every guy. And the two that year were Carl Eller, the Minnesota Vikings defensive end, and Art Shell, the Oakland Raiders tackle. And Art was always real good. He'd been there numerous times. It was the first time I'd been with Carl, and he was very helpful. And when we reduced it from 21 to 15 to 10 to 5 in the final two, we were surprised that we had put in Kramer. We never go, well, let's put in this guy, or you vote this guy, vote that guy. All of a sudden, Jerry Kramer and Robert Brazil were the two senior nominees. And so I don't know why, other than the fact there were a lot of great offensive linemen through the decades, but I know Jerry was famous for not being in the Hall of Fame. And now that he is, he can't tell people he's not. So it's almost, I know he's incredibly happy, as he should be, but when I saw him, I told him, I'm sorry it took us so long to get you in. He was so happy. At that point, he did not care.
Bert, thank you for the call. John, as you know, the 10-year anniversary of Steve McNair's death, it comes up on July 4th. Hard to believe it's been a decade since that murder. And I'm curious, as you reflect back on the career of Steve McNair, what comes to mind?
I was where I just came back from Waco for my 37th softball reunion. Former media people who used to work there against current media people. Mainly, we have a lot of kids and grandkids who play now, and for the last 10 years, I just managed my team. And a good friend of mine from the Chronicle had broken both wrists and a hip when he hit a wall behind home plate. And I was at the hospital in the emergency room, and George Plaster called me and said, have you heard about McNair? And I'm thinking, why is he calling me about Bob McNair? And the Texans owner. And I said, what happened? He said, well, do you know what's going to hit the fan? They found him dead, looks like a murder-suicide. And I'm thinking, what in the world, Bob McNair? And then it dawned on me, he was talking about Steve McNair, and I was just as shocked. And that was the first thing. And I've reflected over his career many times because I was here the day they brought him in on Bud Adams' plane after appearing in New York at the draft as third overall pick in 95. And I jotted down some things after you told me you were going to ask me this. And the first thing, Steve signed a 7-year contract. You can't do that anymore. And there were no outs. So they could afford to rest, keep to make sure they developed him. And the offensive coordinator, Jerry Rome, Jeff Fisher's first full season in 95, they signed Chris Chandler, who Jerry Rome had in Arizona. And Chris was an experienced veteran who helped them go 8-8, but nobody liked him. Everybody wanted to see the phenom. And so finally, at the end of the first year, Chandler was hurt. Steve played, and they won his two starts. So we assumed, okay, next year McNair is going to be the quarterback, but he wouldn't. It was Chandler again. It wasn't until they got to Nashville in 97 that Steve became the full-time starter. But watching him in those first two, he didn't do anything spectacular, but they won both games, and he would flash how tough he was to pull down because he was so strong, country strong, as Fisher always called it. And we saw it, and we thought all that off season we're going to get to see Steve McNair next year, but we didn't. And then, of course, his greatest days were experienced when he was with the Titans. In 1998, when they were the Tennessee Oilers, I was covering this game, and they were in Tampa. And they won 31-22. They were up 24-22 with a little more than 2 minutes left. And Steve had one of the best runs I've ever seen, 71 yards, to turn that 24-22 lead into a 31-22 victory. At the two-minute warning, that game he only threw for 123 yards, no touchdowns. But he ran 8 times for 95 yards and that 71-yard touchdown. And you don't see many better than that. And he broke a lot of tackles, and it was fun to watch. So that was in 1998. two other things that stand out. You guys will have to fill me in. I thought one of these was involving Kansas City. He got hurt, and the fans cheered when Neil O'Donnell came in. He told Fisher that he was going to quit. And Jeff told him I think Jeff told him, wait another 2 or 3 weeks. And he was hurt, sternum. I think he had a sternum injury and was held together by chicken wire. And then I can't remember if it was the next game or what, O'Donnell got hurt. He went in, he pulled out the victory. Players said they could hear the chicken wire when he would breathe, holding his sternum together. And as they walked off the field, Fisher said, "You still want to quit?" He's, "No, coach, I got it." And the rest was history. And that kind of was a turning point in his career. And the other two happened in the same game. You guys know what I'm talking about. At the end of the Super Bowl, the pass in which he put his hand down to keep from getting tackled and broke two guys all over him, completed the 16-yard pass to Kevin Dyson, which was so much Steve McNair about how strong he was, about what a clutch big play guy he was. And then the one he'll be noted for the most, which is unfair because it'll be shown on TV as long as there's TV or handhelds or whatever, was coming up 1 yard short against the Rams on the completion of Kevin Dyson.
All great ones. They keep showing the long 71-yard run in Tampa on NFL Network every now and then when I see it.
Well, that's what it reminded me of. I remember when he did it, weaving, breaking tackles and weaving in and out of the Buccaneers.
Yeah.
And having enough gas left at the end of a physical game to run 71 yards on the road outside, that was the essence of Steve McNair. And it was so early in his career, we didn't know that much about him. Thought maybe at that time he's going to be a runner and not a passer. And he certainly was against the Buccaneers.
John, what do you do for the 4th in Houston?
We're going out of town on the 4th. Ordinarily, we go watch fireworks at night. We're going up to Chesapeake Bay and spend a few days up there and then come back. And every time I'm in town, I'm writing. I'm writing 4 things before I go while I'm gone. But we'll be spending some time by the water.
Like in Virginia?
Maryland.
Yeah, okay.
Nice.
Close to Annapolis.
I got family in Chesapeake, so I'll shoot you some ideas there.
It's a lot of fun. We have a blast there. We're going into D.C. to see the Spy Museum. Carol asked me if I wanted to see the Orioles. I said, no, I don't see losing baseball anymore. And she said, what about the Nationals?
You're missing out.
She asked me, they were terrible. Now they're 1 game over .500, yeah. But I like to watch good baseball here.
John, thank you as always. Happy 4th to you. We'll catch up next week.
That sounds great, guys. Thank you very much.